Welcome to this special episode of the Reliability Matters podcast. This episode is available as a traditional audio podcast and as a video podcast. If you're listening to this on your podcast app, there's also a video version available on aqueoustech.com in the podcast section and on mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Today's episode is entitled Meet the Press. I invited a few of our industry's journalist icons in to discuss current industry events from the pandemic to supply chain to innovation and more. Join my conversation with Mike Buto, Editor-in-Chief of Printed Circuit Design and Fab and Circuits Assembly Magazines, and the host of the PCB Chat podcast. Trevor Galbraith, publisher of Global SMT and Packaging Magazine, and host of a weekly Tech Thursday show and panel discussion. And Phil Stoughton, founder of Scoop TV and industry shows like C-Level, Made In, and others. It turns out these journalists have a lot to say. Who would have guessed that? We'll be right back in just a moment.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Well, thanks everybody for joining me today. Thanks for agreeing to be my guest, my guests on this special episode of Reliability Matters, which we're calling Meet the Press. So I appreciate you all being here.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Mike. So let's, since we have four or three press people in the room, let me get your opinions about the 800-pound virus in the room. Every time I talk to somebody, it seems we always bring up COVID, and I don't want this to be a COVID-specific episode because I'm kind of tired of the whole thing. I think the whole world is kind of tired of the whole thing. It's here. It's not going away anytime soon, so it's kind of a new reality. But how are you guys in your business of press handling COVID, and what's changed in your daily routine in bringing the news of our industry out to your subscribers? And anyone who wants to take that, go ahead and go with it.
I'm sorry, Mike. What's COVID?
That's okay. We can end. Thanks for joining us. We see we've solved it. That's great. You sound like an elected official in Washington.
So. Yeah. I think everything's gone a lot more virtual, of course. You know, we're all doing a lot more webinars, panel discussions, and, you know, digital media. We're probably better placed for it than most people because we've all got respective large mailing lists and, you know, we have access to the public in that respect. Not a lot has changed other than the fact that we're doing a lot more work from home. We're actually, and I think my co-panelists will probably agree that we're all working harder. I'm working definitely more hours than I used to be before pre-COVID, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, speaking as the guy who's on this call at 1 a.m., I would agree with that. Everybody's doing more hours. I think what's been interesting, and I think what was really interesting to me at the start of the process is you got to feel like a real journalist for a while. You were covering stuff, news was breaking every day. Clients were on the phone saying, you know, where do we live in the story? How do we frame things? Is there stuff we can do in terms of helping with PPE and stuff? So people in the manufacturing industry suddenly were important. And, you know, I covered a story with PCH International, a manufacturing as a service company that were making PPE for Bono of U2. So suddenly Bono is involved in the supply chain. He's on, you know, first name terms and speed dial with a guy that's organizing manufacturing for him in China, and he's renting Norwegian airline planes to fly PPE over to Ireland to his local hospitals. So it kind of changed the way I think initially we responded as journalists, and that was, I think, really interesting, and stories were moving fast. And then, as Trevor said, it kind of switched over to this mode where everything we'd been doing in the past, everything we'd do at a trade show, we'd got to figure out how to do at home. suddenly we all learned how to do green screen. So, you know, people weren't just staring at our lounges or our studies or our spare bedrooms or wherever we were working from. And we, you know, started to explore these virtual modes. And I think we're doing more and more of that. You know, every week I'm talking to people about a trade show that's likely going to be cancelled and what they're going to be doing instead. And, you know, initially it was SMT Nuremberg, and then it got shifted out to what's going to happen with SMT AI, and now people are talking about Electronica, and people are even talking about Apex next year. So, you know, curious times.
Yeah,
I think the key statement that I remember was Steve Mnuchin coming on and saying that he doesn't expect any international travel to resume till next year. So it really is, you know, and of course Microsoft saying that, mandating to their staff and Facebook as well, that no major meetings to be held till at least June of next year. So that really does push things out a bit.
Yeah, this morning I got a call this morning.
Your question, you know, I would agree with Trevor and Phil, of course. The thing that I noted was that not necessarily that the volume of work became greater, but, you know, I'm not running off now to coach baseball or to coach basketball like I usually would be, okay? So, you know, my work day all of a sudden got extended. And without other social things necessarily to be able to do, what else are you going to do? So you kind of sit in front of your computer for a longer period of time. You spend more time doing the things that you would ordinarily have to compress because you have so many other things you're trying to fit in. And what I've found, you know, I'm not traveling to visit a shop a week, which was my usual routine, okay? So it gives you more time, I think, to sit back and think. But you try to figure out what it is that we want to do, and where do we fit in, and what does the industry need, and you know, where are the gaps? Because where there are gaps, there's opportunities. And so you do a lot more strategic planning, I believe, than you typically would get to do in our field.
Have you been writing more, Mike?
Yes and no. You know, I don't trust what I don't see. So I've been doing a lot of podcasts, more so probably than I typically would, and I have been talking to more people, but I don't know that I've really been writing more because, again, you know, I don't like to take somebody's word for it. I want to see what's really there. You know, we've got a state-of-the-art factory. Great. Okay. Let me come look. Well, let me see for myself. Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. That machine's 12 years old. Maybe not state-of-the-art. Works, but maybe not state-of-the-art. So, you know, that's the kind of verification I like to do. But, you know, to your question, Phil, probably not more writing, but a little bit different kind of writing.
Yeah, I think I've been writing more, but I think I've been reading more as well. You know, I find myself reading more about, you know, what you guys are writing and what else is going on in the market. So, yeah, I think that's been, for me, that's been really interesting.
So that's where all those clicks are coming from.
There you go. It's me reading.
It's us reading us. Yeah. So let's talk about trade shows for a second. Trevor, you just produced the first that I've seen. There's probably many others in other industries, but in our industry, you produced the first kind of mini virtual trade show last week.
Right.
And Mike, you are working on, I think, a virtual trade show right now that's coming out. So, Trevor, what was your takeaway from the virtual trade show? What were the pros and cons? What needs to be improved, if anything? What kind of trajectory are we on? And then I'll ask Mike kind of what he's expecting and some of the challenges and opportunities that he sees moving forward.
Right. Well, if I gave you the full list, it would take much longer than this program, believe me. But it was an experiment, and I think the experiment on the whole went very well. Everybody seemed very happy with it. Yes, it's got a lot of challenges associated with it, the communication. And although we're working in an industry full of engineers, believe it or not, they're really not that tech savvy when it comes to things like this, for example. So there's a lot of preparation work, pre-prep done behind the scenes. I think we all know from working with people in the industry that we have to pre-record most of our things. It's very little of it is done live, so there's a lot of work, as I say, behind the scenes. The one thing that we've all got in common, as I said earlier in the program, is that we all have access to very large mailing lists, and that's a prerequisite. You need to be able to stage something like these. But it's definitely going to be, we're still on a learning curve with it. We've got a massive meeting coming up on Friday to basically do a big autopsy, but I think on the whole, the feedback from customers and from people alike was, they were very happy with it.
Good, yeah. It was, you invited me to be part of it as a kind of a co-host, a talking head in between segments. And it I think from a technical standpoint, it rolled out pretty smoothly. From what I can see on this end, so
I think we had one platform or one browser that wasn't playing nice with us, you know. So that sort of made us think, you know, we need to do a lot more testing ahead of time. Make sure every platform, every browser is fully tested before you launch anything like that.
Right. Chrome works the best for pretty much everything. Once you start straying from Chrome, it's hit and miss.
It does, but I think Chrome is one of the difficult ones this time. So,
oh wow!
I think on the whole, it went really, really well. We're just looking to see what we'll do with that platform in the future. But we can, you know, we're lucky that we actually have all the capabilities in house to do the 3D rendering and imaging and all the rest of it to create the virtual booths, the virtual lobbies and theaters. So we can repurpose that in any way we want. It's an exciting new challenge.
Mike, you have a show coming up. Which show is it and when is it?
Right. So PCB West will be coming up in mid-September. Dates are September 7th to the 10th. It's a conference and exhibition. I wanted to mention, you know, I was looking forward to Trevor's event, of course, and one of the things I've always admired about Trevor is his willingness to, you know, try new things. He will always dive in, and that's great. Now, it should be encouraged and rewarded.
Well, you can tell the arrows in my back, Mike.
No arrows. Now, we actually did try a virtual trade show, going back 13 years ago. We did 4 years of virtual PCB.
I do remember that.
You know, I think that was probably a little bit ahead of its time. I'm not sure that the time for virtual shows is even now, quite frankly. I think that there's a population that's still trying to understand how they will work and whether they can extract the type of information that they really want from these types of events. That said, what will make this show different for us relative to the ones that we did, you know, a decade ago is that, you know, we are, all of our programming, 125 hours worth of technical training is going to be online. You know, all these webinars will be rolled out and available for a month. And so one of the things that we hear back from the live show is, hey, look, I'm here for a week and there's just too much going on. I can't get to everything I want to get to, because the nature of our shows is very different than, say, an IPC Apex or an SMT AI, where those are sort of paper sessions. Somebody talks for 20 minutes, then there's 5 minutes of Q&A, then change over to the next speaker, repeat ad nauseum for 3 or 4 days. Ours are really designed to teach people how to design and build circuit boards. And that's not something that people can really get in colleges and universities right now. They're going to get it on the job, but they can't get it at most conferences. And so that's the gap that we're trying to fill. And the way that we're trying to do that is by putting a 7-hour webinar online. A 7-hour presentation online. So somebody can watch this, they can watch it piecemeal, they can watch it all the way through if the time permits, they can go back, they'll be able to see Rick Hartley, you know, 4 days, and then Eric Bogatin 2 more days, and then, you know, you name it, really Richie for a couple days, and they can't do that in a physical show because you can't be in multiple places at once, and because of the parameters, people have to speak at the same time. So we will see whether this works, whether the industry is ready for this. I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah, I'm curious about it. It's been, I've found it really interesting because I've come at it from a different angle. You know, we we do events and we do stuff like that, but we also content consult for a lot of clients that have had their trade shows cancelled and are trying to figure out what they should be doing to replace them. And we kind of come at it from the opposite side, rather than saying, hey, let's just, instead of going to the real show, let's do the virtual show. We're asking people, what are the deliverables from the event? What do they expect to get from that event? How many leads would they typically generate? How many customers would they see? How many thought leadership opportunities would they have? And how many maybe media meetings they'd have? And then try and look at how that can be delivered with other tools. So not necessarily a virtual trade show, but in some cases a virtual trade show, but in other cases, you know, a mix of webinars, maybe standing up a bi-weekly live show for them or something like that, creating stuff that creates that lead generation, creates that thought leadership, stems that requirement for press interest, but does it in different ways. And I think more and more people are doing that now. And as a result of doing that, when they get to the next show cycle, they might not look at it in quite the same way. You know, the bang for buck they're getting from a show is really interesting. And when I have discussions with people about specific shows, and I'm not going to name names, they're like, I'm quite relieved that one's not happening, because I only went to that one because all my competitors did.
FOMO, a little FOMO.
Something else in its, yeah, and now they're doing something else in its place, which is quantifiable, has got specific KPIs, has got specific return on investment, and they're going to benchmark that show against that next year. So, you know,
it's a very interesting observation. I mean, I think the deliverables are much bigger on these shows, so you can actually see how many people come into your booth, how many people lifted a brochure, how many people watched the video, etc. So it's definitely a lot more measurable, which is
And if you simply compare a webinar with a presentation at a conference, if you present at a conference, you can see how many people there are in the audience, and you'll get the business cards of a few that come up and talk to you afterwards. If you do a webinar, you've got a registration list of 100 people or whatever that number is. You know, we do shows recently with Mike McNamara and Mondello that have like 500 plus people in. You can see exactly who those people are. They've said, we're interested in that topic and we'll give you an hour of our time. That's a high level of qualified lead out of something when you compare it to a standing up at a conference where you don't necessarily know who's in the audience. So I think it's interesting, and I think it'll change the marketing mix. And, you know, I'm sure we're all talking to marketing managers about how they're getting through this time, and most of them have got budget pressure as well as supply issues in terms of conferences. So I think their thought process is changing somewhat.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what Phil and Trevor are leading up to is that there still needs, it's still a work in progress to figure out what metrics are the right ones, and those are going to vary from company to company. I would add that OEMs, many OEMs and some EMS companies have been doing virtual training for years. And so that part of the equation really isn't new. It's the notion of paying for this, because there should be a price to have access to these experts. You may spend $10,000 a day to have Rick Hartley come into your facility. That's not an exaggeration. So now you can get that for a fraction of it. Is it worth it? You know, it's just a different process in so far as making that decision.
Yeah, I think the two takeaways that I can see from this end for virtual is, you know, you cannot make an argument that you can get 100% of the value that you would normally receive in a physical event from a virtual event. You can't. You don't have you can't look at the guy raising his eyebrow when you're making a claim. You know, you can't get that interpersonal takeaway. However, the cost is, you know, anywhere from free to a, you know, fraction of what it is. So even if as an exhibitor or a speaker, you know, I, I might only get 10% of the takeaway of a physical show, but I have, you know, virtually zero cost of entry, so, or barrier to entry. Yeah. So,
well, I slightly disagree with you there, Mike. I'll give you an interesting example. Gainsight do a called Gainsight Pulse. It normally has 5,500 visitors, so it's a huge, huge, huge event with some really major companies. They stood that up as an online event this year, and they had it over a slightly longer period, but they got 22,000 visitors. So they actually, their ROI, their return on investment was higher. So they had, you know, 400% of the value of the face-to-face, if you look in terms of the number of people that visited, and they did it without having to, you know, basically rent a Las Vegas casino.
So just the opposite, the opposite effect, greater takeaway.
Yeah, so they completely flipped the equation. I'm not saying that's an example that works everywhere, but I think it's a fascinating paradigm shift that we're potentially going to see in the way trade shows operate. And Mike makes a great point that it's, you know, it's not just about the sponsors and the value they get, it's about the value that the attendees get. And, you know, every time I go to a trade show, and every time Trevor goes to a trade show, and every Mike goes to a trade show, we're spending our time interviewing people, we're spending our time talking to people. We haven't got time to go to the conference. So for us to have access to that conference in a virtual mode is actually more attractive, and we can watch it on demand. And, you know, if we can't sleep at night, that's we just go and watch Trevor's Tech Talk Thursday or something.
Oh, there goes the arrow. Yeah, there they go.
There's going to be this program, by the way. Another interesting takeaway from our online expo last week was we had some exhibitors. We set all our exhibitors up with Zoom rooms in the Zoom cafe kind of thing. And one of them was a pick and place manufacturer, and he was literally doing virtual tours around his showroom. A customer would come in, a visitor would come into his room and say, well, I'm interested in a pick and place machine. And the guy would get his cell phone and literally walk across the showroom and say, well, and explain the machine to him and show him the parts. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's awesome.
Well,
I think it was at Apex maybe 5-6 years ago. It was a while ago, but I believe it was Viscom, and I'm sure I'll hear from them if I have the company wrong, that didn't have equipment in their booth, but they actually had a tech back in Germany who was doing live demos. And so somebody would come to their booth, and he would ask them what they wanted to see, and they'd tell him, and he would walk around the showroom and run demos for them. You know, he had the cameras and all the rest of it, and that poor soul, you know, being, I don't know how many, 8 time zones away from Los Angeles or wherever we were that year, he was up late. But, you know, the point being is that there's lots of little tricks and innovations and things like that that people have tried. It takes a long time. I don't think that this industry is any different than any other. It takes a long time for new ideas to work their way into the mainstream. And so much in the way that we're still talking about through-hole and wave soldering today, just like we did in 1990 when it was the dominant technology, we will be working our way into this hybrid physical virtual model, I think, over the next several years to come.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think one thing I've learned as well through doing weekly panel discussions and things like that is that I'm getting more real feedback on what topics are interesting our viewers. Because you're getting real numbers. So that is good, because before, we had a good idea of what's of interest and what's topical, but, you know, getting hard feedback was hard sometimes, you know. So the digital world has made that a lot easier.
Yeah, being data-driven is valuable.
So calamities open the door to opportunities. And one of the countries that's seen a new opportunity, from what I read, probably from your good reporting, is major investments happening in Vietnam right now. So what do y'all know about that? Do you see Vietnam? Vietnam has for many years been threatening to, you know, be the next China, so to speak. And it really hasn't happened. Brazil was supposed to be the next China for a while, and that of course didn't happen.
Yeah.
Do you think this is an opportunity for other countries to actually truly gain a foothold on the supply chain business?
Yeah,
absolutely, 100%. If I can just take Vietnam quickly, Vietnam's got lots of good infrastructure and good resources to be a good option. I think a lot of people that are looking at Vietnam aren't looking as a option to replace China. They're looking at China plus one or China plus many, and Vietnam as being part of that. China manufactures $4 trillion worth of goods, and Vietnam does about 40 billion, so that's 1%. So there's a different size there. I think what people have to realize is the supply chain runs very deep in China. So even if you're manufacturing in Vietnam, a lot of those, a lot of the components are coming out of China anyway. So its proximity to China is really valuable to it. It's got a good education system, good infrastructure. Seems very stable. So the supply chain guys, supply chain consultants that I work with and I talk to regularly, are all very serious about Vietnam. So I think Vietnam will do well. But I think on a more broader base, that idea of supply chain shifting out of China. There was a report out this week from a Ghana thing that said 33% of companies were either moving supply chain out of China or were considering doing it in the next 2 to 3 years. I would suggest that most of that 33% are considering doing it rather than actually doing it. It's not as simple as a process as one would imagine. Obviously, some sectors will do it much quicker. Those sectors that have to and where that dominance of China is too risky. But I think China will remain the factory of the world for some considerable time.
Okay. I think, to Philip's point, the Vietnam, first of all, I mean, it's actually been, they've been shifting manufacturing from China to Vietnam for some years now, initially because of the low labor rate, but in actual fact, it's catching up fast, and that benefit is really quite narrow now. But that was the initial driver for Vietnam, and I think that will continue. Going on to the China plus one strategy, I do see that happening, and because I honestly think a lot of companies and some countries, of course, are basically losing trust in China as a trading partner. Now, they can't afford to ignore China because it's such a huge market in itself. But they don't want to be involved there when there's so many different issues going on and so many different political issues, the trade wars, etc., which people think is going to be an ongoing situation for the next decade, no matter what administration's in. So there are people who are seriously considering spreading the risk and taking the risk away from having everything based in the one place in China. But I think Mexico and Eastern Europe are probably going to be the biggest beneficiaries of that.
That's very good. Mike, you've written about China for years, way before this pandemic. And a lot of your editorial has been critical of certain things about China manufacturing. Do you have a horse in this race on the thought of permanent changes as a result of this pandemic to the supply chain, or do you think we'll go back to normal?
Who, me? Critical? China? What?
What? Mike Buto? No way.
Straight shooter?
Yeah. I first visited China in 2000, okay? And, you know, at the time, you couldn't find any street signs in English. There was some small expat communities. There was a lot of construction going on. You know, fast forward to today, now there's dog parks. There's Starbucks all over the place. There's street signs in English. There's really big expat communities of, you know, more than just English. I mean, it's really transformed, right? The bloom is off the rose, and it has been for some time. The industry does tend to follow the herd. We get pressed by financiers and Wall Street to have a solution. Sometimes it's the China solution. You know, what will it be next? Maybe the Mexico solution, as Trevor intimated. My question is whether manufacturing right now is truly shifting to Vietnam, which was the original question, or whether it's expanding into Vietnam. Because what I'm seeing is really more of the latter. Will it shift over time? Perhaps. You know, Vietnam is, according to Foxconn, its largest manufacturing hub in Southeast Asia outside of China. So they've invested a couple hundred million there in the last 2 years. The bare board fabrication market for China is larger than that of the U.S., and they only have a dozen or so real manufacturers. So the companies that are doing bare boards there are actually doing a lot of work. They're doing, you know, $3 billion a year or thereabouts in bare board fab. It doesn't have the population that some of these other countries do. I think its population is, 70, 80 million, something like that. So, you know, China is 1.3 billion, India is 1.3 or so, you know, Mexico's, you know, 150 to 200 million, yeah. I'm not exactly sure. But, yeah. You know, so they will run out of headroom at a certain point in terms of being able to maintain that low hourly wage point, right? But it's really interesting. You know, they're very friendly with the U.S. It's a model for how a country that was completely at odds with us 40 years ago can shift dramatically, 180 degrees, and by us, I mean the United States. But Vietnam clearly wants to be an international player and has taken an open approach without all of the hang-ups that that China's government has invoked. So I see potential there, you know, more so than what we have so far. But will they be able to compete with larger populations? I think Malaysia and some of the other farther southern Asian nations probably have a better opportunity.
Yeah, and they have some great infrastructure. What's really ironic, Mike, is that the very people that you mentioned from Wall Street that were telling China, 10 years ago, are the same people that are saying, hey, aren't we too dependent on China now?
Right.
So it's the same voices, and you're like, do you remember what you said? It's kind of ironic. But I think what we're seeing is, in terms of supply chain, a change in the thought process when they're designing a supply chain, and we're moving away from just-in-time to something that's more based around just-in-case. We're moving from supply chains that are very focused on specific geographies to supply chains that are more resilient, perhaps more agile. And I think part of that is a desire to accelerate digital transformation at the same time. And, you know, pandemics and crisis tend to not start trends, but they do accelerate trends. And it may well be that they're accelerating a trend in the virtual trade show world, but they're definitely accelerating a trend in terms of digital transformation, even more so in supply chain than it is in manufacturing, in my opinion.
I don't want to lose sight of the fact that, you know, some of the trade war issues, tariffs and things like that, really have had an impact, right? I mean, if we go back to 2018 and we look at the electronics imports to the U.S., just using the Census Bureau data, China was actually up in 2018. Mexico was up. Philippines were up big. Taiwan was up year over year, but down versus 2017. Vietnam was down year over year in 2018. It was 2019 where we saw Vietnam spike. It was up 80% year over year, okay? China was down about 20%. And I think that's the trade war impact.
Yeah.
And that's going to continue going forward.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think one of the other dynamics that came out of this COVID business is that every country, in many ways, was every man for himself with regards to PPE and other critical equipment. And so a lot of countries are really now starting to look at trying to mitigate that risk by reshoring some critical manufacturing as well. So there's other dynamics that play there as well.
I think that falls into, Phil, you coined, or you repeated the phrase, just in case. That seems to be a lot of CYA, yeah. just in case plans going on. We'll see if they stick. Let's switch topics for the moment and talk about innovation. One of the things I'm jealous of in your jobs is you typically get a little advanced peek on innovative things. I like to put everything into one of two categories. There's either a revolutionary idea or an evolutionary idea. It's either revolution or evolution. So the internet, for example, revolution. Wi-Fi, probably revolution. IoT, 5G, evolution. It's just taking something, making it faster, better, cheaper, smaller, et cetera. Do you see any revolution going on in our industry? And if so, what is it? And then if not, or in addition to that, what type of evolutionary things do you see going on in our industry?
Well, I don't see anything revolutionary because Joe Felstad's idea didn't take off with the solderless boards. There's a lot of evolutionary stuff, of course. And you could argue that the Industry 4.0 smart factory stuff is part of that. But it seems to be getting rolled out or practiced by the tier one players, really. It's not really trickling down to the tier threes and tier fours. But there is some good stuff coming through. For example, by using data and measurement to improve and reduce the defects at the print process and areas like that. So there are some evolutionary steps that are starting to work their way into SMT manufacturing. But I wouldn't call any of them revolutionary, really.
No, no revolution there. And there's no fourth industrial revolution, by the way. That's a myth, too.
We're myth-busting today.
Yeah, I think there was probably only one real industrial revolution, and the rest were just evolution. I think some of the trends that I'm seeing a lot of in terms of evolutionary are the way automation's being applied, and we're seeing more adaptable automation, which I think is really interesting. So smart use of software-driven robotics, those kind of things. And then the other thing that I think has been really interesting this year is more and more innovative business models. So more and more digital manufacturing platforms, digital manufacturing ecosystems, people doing manufacturing as a service, robotics as a service, those kind of things I think are changing the industry. And I think they'll become even more important if we look at where EMS companies are going to be over the next 12 to 18 months in terms of being able to invest in capital equipment. I think those companies that have got as a service offerings that can shift the investment from CapEx to OpEx have got some really interesting opportunities. So I think there's plenty of innovation going on in the industry. I think most people believe, again, that the pandemic will accelerate some of that innovation and push people down certain routes. But yeah, no revolution, no huge seismic shift in how boards are assembled or how products are manufactured.
Yeah, I can't see anything revolutionary right now either. Sorry, Mike?
We got to think of these things in terms of a continuum, right? And so perhaps what we should do is go back 20 years to see what we were writing about then. And Lord help us all, we've all been around that long and even longer, right? And to see what was being talked about then as new and then see where that is today. I'll give you an example, like MCMs. You know, they were big in 94 and then sort of put on the shelf and we forgot about them. And guess what? MCM design software reached its highest level ever last quarter. You know, they're back. You know, they never really went away, but it just takes a long time, right, for new ideas to take hold. You know, we're in an industry that is, by its nature, risk averse. You know, product has to work. And so, you know, you have to test things out over a long period of time, and then you have to create a business case for making the transition as well as the technical case. And so, you know, some of the things that I see are, you know, augmented reality, which is absolutely working its way in, not just our field, but a lot of fields. And, you know, if you can teach surgery using that, then you can certainly have a place for it in electronics manufacturing, at least on the training side. touchless fabrication processes, where we have now multiple plants in the U.S. and several more in Asia that essentially are lights out all the way through. And that's a big deal because fabrication has historically been a very labor-intensive process. Now, there are limits to what they can build because you can't, if you have to tool lots of different part numbers, then, you know, that's going to require manual changeover. But, you know, robots and things like that, you know, the AGVs are improving. You know, again, we go back to, I think I saw, it was 2001 at Productronica, and I went over to visit Isola in Dürren, Germany, and they had AGVs all over the plant, you know, moving laminate material around. So it just takes a long time, right, for these things to really work their way into the mainstream. One other thing that I'm kind of watching is the transition of, this is at a higher level, right, but the transition of the traditional EMS company to ODM and then possibly OEM. And so you see, you know, EMS guys always said, hey, look, we're not going to get into that business. You know, we're not going to compete with our customers, except that now that they are. And guys like Benchmark have gone totally opposite of the, you know, outsource everything to now Benchmark put in a fab line into its plant in Phoenix, Arizona, where there's no water, right? You know, so this is a water intensive process. And they've put a fabrication plan. You don't do fabrication in the U.S., right? They're going completely against the stream. Okay, to me, that's innovative. That's new. And will that take hold? That's something to watch.
Yeah, no, that's, and, yeah. Is it not Arizona where TSMC is going to put their next fab? I think that was where they chose. It's an interesting area. But one of the things I find really exciting as well through all this digital software that we're improving. The real possibility of having real DFM. The industry's been trying to really get their hands around this design for manufacturing thing for years and years, and it's just not been possible. There's always been this disconnect between the designer, the product having to take five or six turns before it gets into production, and then all the issues you have further down the line. So it's really exciting to see that some companies are really starting to be able to start to close that DFM loop.
And do you guys see AI as being a big opportunity in our industry, just to manage all that data, all that complexity? Do you see artificial intelligence being, and obviously there are plenty of companies there that are waving the AI flag on their booth, but do you see actual good use cases?
I see a lot of people using assisted intelligence. I wouldn't call it artificial. I believe if you're working with libraries, then essentially you're working with assisted intelligence. If you're using artificial intelligence, then the machine's making the decision itself. And I think we're a long way off of that.
Well, I think AI is a buzzword right now. Everyone wants to say it's AI. I see cheap IoT kind of consumer stuff that says it has AI in it. And I'm like, no, this isn't HAL. It's not gonna kill me. It's not gonna be Rise of the Machines. I don't think we're quite there at that point.
There's a handful of companies from Intel down to Zukin and Mentor, Cadence.
Yeah,
they've all been working on AI routers. And, you know, it's something to kind of keep an eye on. They are really top-level engineers. We're talking about PhDs in artificial intelligence that have been brought on board to develop these tools. And so it's an expensive undertaking. And auto routing has been, you know, kind of the bugaboo of the industry since the first router was developed. You know, most of them, you know, they don't really complete a difficult job. They get you most of the way there, but somebody has to kind of finish it, and then they go back and they look at it, and they don't really like how it looks anyway, and so they go back and do a lot of it by hand. So but it is something to watch. Again, it's going to take a long time, in my opinion.
Yeah, that will be perhaps revolutionary once it completes its path in 20 years, right? But we talked about it here first. So let's talk about the contraction of the number of of companies in our industry. So you all remember, we talked about being in this business a long time. I remember my first trade show, which was NEPCON West in, I think it was 1985 or 86. And there was the arena where they played basketball. That was filled with booths. Mm-hmm. The hallway that connected all the exhibition halls together were full. Hall A, B, C, eventually D, the parking lot had a tent, and there was two hotels, the Hilton and the Marriott, that had exposition space in it. And there were thousands, thousands of exhibitors. Today, a successful trade show in North America will have, you know, maybe two halls with you know, a fraction of the number of booths. Prototronica, the old Prototronica that had at the old fairgrounds, that had 26 separate buildings that they put the show in, you know, then went into the new airport facility, and you know, they've contracted quite a bit too. And then I consider companies that are doing a lot of purchasing of companies, holding companies like ITW or Nordson or ASM. They have their portfolio companies that are buying up, you know, best in class, supposedly. So is that good for our industry? Is that bad for our industry? Does that restrict innovation? Does that, you know, does the ITW 80-20 rule, you know, come back to bite our industry, or do you think, and serve the shareholders, or do you think there's value in pumping that kind of money into this, into various companies?
I don't think there's necessarily been a contraction. I think it's been more a consolidation in some ways through M&A activity. But part of what you were talking about, of course, has been with NEPCON West back in the day, was the shift to Asia. All the manufacturing went. I mean, I remember 1999, I think it was, but the last year of NEPCON West, it had 30,000 visitors. The following year, 2000, we had Apex, which had, I think, something in the region of 10,000, and NEPCON West had 10,000 as well. So you could see the change, the sea change happening right there. But, you know, there has been a lot of consolidation and mergers and activities between contract manufacturers in North America and around the world. That's ongoing, actually. If we get to the bigger any company gets, though, the more that it's controlled by the bean counters, and that's where your 80-20 thing comes in. So the bigger you get, the more you're likely to do that. I'm not sure that's the best way to go, because you start to lose sight of some of your innovation, because you only cater for development for your top 20% of your customers.
I think you can lose innovation there with some of those big ones, but I also think you can gain in other ways when they look at bringing lines together. I think, you know, interestingly, you mentioned ASM. I think they've done a nice job of being creative. But just as those companies consolidate and grow bigger and bigger and bigger, there are still plenty of small, innovative, agile companies in the industry. You know, I talk to CEOs every day of some of the smaller companies in our industry, and they're coming up with new stuff constantly. So I think there's still plenty of innovation in terms of equipment, in terms of software in the industry. And I think as it gets kind of extracted at the top from the large companies, thanks to the acquisition by companies like ITW that do apply that 80-20 rule, there's still plenty of new innovative ideas that are coming in at the bottom end, and, you know, are actually funded and excited because they do have the opportunity and that path to, you know, eventual exit and an acquisition. So I don't think it's necessarily hurting the industry. When you look at it from an EMS point of view, obviously we're not in that heavy acquisition period that we were in kind of at the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, when you saw, you know, things like Flextronics acquiring Selectron and those kind of major acquisitions. But we're seeing some of them, and we're seeing groups appearing in Europe and in the US and in different parts of the world. And you need to have those different contract manufacturers for different OEMs. So some OEMs have a global marketplace. They need stuff in to be shipped to China. They need stuff to be shipped to the US. They need stuff to be shipped into Europe. And they need a manufacturer that is global and has got locations in all of those places. And then there are, you know, OEMs that are maybe in Idaho, and most of their markets in Idaho, and you know, they want an EMS company that's in Idaho as well. So I think it makes sense that there are those, there is that consolidation, but there's still plenty of innovation, I think, feeding the top of the funnel to get people, to get new companies into the market.
Very good, Mike. Do you have any insight on that?
So I'm not sure. I've never been able to figure out whether trade shows are representative of the industry or just the local culture, right? Because the U.S. is still the largest electronics market from a design standpoint, and this is where most of the world's significant OEMs are, and there are tons of new startups, you know, every year. That's not to diminish anything that's going on anywhere else, but the Silicon Valley is still where companies aspire to be. And yet, you know, we don't pack in our shows the way that Productronica does in Europe, or any of the shows do in China, or particularly the Japanese, the big NEPCON show in Japan.
Yeah,
massive, you know, 100,000 people. So it's logarithmically larger than the US's events. So is that the size of the market, or is that the culture? That said, from an industry perspective, any contraction that may be going on, it hasn't seemed to make a dent in Foxconn standing as the largest ODM / EMS company, right? I mean, they're as large as the next three guys combined, and they're doing it generally through organic growth. You know, they go and buy Sharp. Well, guess what? It barely makes a dent in their size, you know, because they're so large. I don't see suppliers as in any type of a monopoly position. I mean, you know, you may see a couple of placement guys combined. Okay, guess what? There's still another, you know, eight significant manufacturers.
Yeah.
There's something like 40 suppliers of soldering equipment. And different companies have different sort of regional advantages, but nobody has more than, you know, 15-18% of the market share. So, you know, even on the printing side, where you have, you know, a smaller number of really big known brands, but there's lots of smaller guys. And so nobody seems to be in a dominant position. The thing that I'm interested in is that the venture capitalists are back in our industry. And so what we're seeing there is, you know, they kind of left back in the mid-2000s. And, you know, we don't see a lot of companies go public in our industry anymore, especially in the U.S. But the VC guys are buying EMS companies again, and they're dabbling in some of the boardroom shops as well. And we're seeing VC guys buy from other VC guys. So now, are roll-ups going on? I'm not seeing evidence of that yet. There's no real fallout. It seems like they're buying and holding. So you may have a company that buys a company on the East Coast and on the West Coast, and they're not contracting anybody. They're holding them both and looking maybe for a Midwest company to join with it, so on and so on. When the market starts to expand, when it truly starts to expand, I think is when the question will become, will the smaller guys, the weaker guys, be able to keep up? And that's where contraction will take place. But I don't think we're there yet.
Very good. We're gonna wrap up with a quick synopsis of your view on Industry 4.0. Where are we on that? I see a lot of smoke. I smell a steak. I haven't quite seen the steak yet. Maybe I'm just looking in the wrong places. What's your input and your insight on Industry 4.0?
Well, I think the activity is mostly in the, as I said earlier, between the tier ones and some of the tier twos. They're the ones that are pushing it, and they're the ones that are going to benefit from it in the outset. I think one of the problems with the smaller companies is that a lot of them differentiate themselves, or they think the differentiator is the software, the system that they use to control the factory and the line. A lot of these are homegrown systems, and you know, they see that as their key differentiator, because one line is very much like the other. You know, there's not an awful lot of difference in SMT technologies these days. So I think the gap is going to continue to get bigger between the tier ones and tier twos, as they get more capable and get more into automation and everything else like that. And then they're going to come back, they're going to start working their way down the food chain and eating up some of these smaller operators too, I think. So that's pretty much where I would see Industry 4.0 going in our industry.
It's a mix, in my opinion. You know, Trevor's right. There is attention being paid to it at the higher levels, and I've had engineers that I respect very highly say this has to happen, that the industry is being too slow about adopting it. And then I'll walk through a factory of a company that is, you know, a major military and aerospace supplier, and you know, not a small company by any stretch. And you know, I'll mention Industry 4.0 and, oh, what do you think about, you know, having people from the outside being able to kind of look in and see what you have going on? And they look at me like I said I just killed their dog. You know, they have no interest in it whatsoever. They think it's a huge risk to their security, to their of their data, their IP. It opens the door for hacking and all sorts of other things. They just don't feel that the security protocols are in place. And then you go to the even smaller guys and the ones that are supplying to the DoD. And they have this massive document of regulations that they have to adhere to in order to ensure the integrity of their data, to the point where they pretty much have to hire a Microsoft programmer in order to handle this. And so are they going to turn around and all of a sudden say, oh, by the way, come on in, guys, like, you know, electronically do whatever you want. There are major, major disconnects between what the customers at the very top level are saying, what the suppliers in the middle are trying to promote, and then what the folks at the ground that are actually building the product are trying to accomplish.
So maybe Industry 4.0 is just a myth. It's not really a thing. I think what I've seen throughout the crisis is more and more talk about digital transformation to give people more visibility, particularly in supply chain, but also on the factory floor. So I think there's a impetus behind behind digital transformation. And I think when I talk to OEMs, they look at their EMS companies, and those that are digitally enabled make it to the list of companies that they're considering, and those that aren't do not. So to a degree, it's become table stakes in terms of getting into that final negotiation, particularly for the larger global OEMs. So I think it's important from that point of view, whether you want to call it Industry 4.0, because really Industry 4.0 is a whole bundle of different things, you know, whether it's connectivity of the line or connectivity in the supply chain, how that data is used, how that data is analyzed. As Mike said, how that data is protected and security, and you know, in some cases, people just aren't going to connect that data to the outside world, and the risks of hacking, and you know, we're all aware of some of the risks that are being talked about in the media at the moment with particular companies. So there's a great deal of additional care being taken on that basis. But I'm absolutely convinced that the companies that will succeed 2 or 3 years from now, when the market is you know, moving forward more aggressively again, are those that are taking this opportunity to digitally transform their business, and you know, right through from business processes, business management, business intelligence, all the way down to what happens on the shop floor.
Very good. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for all your time. I do want to leave with a few plugs. All of you do really valuable things for our industry. Phil, you have several things going on. You've got your C-level and your made-in. Tell us just real quick about that and how people can view those types of events that you put on.
Yeah, so EMS at C-level was just a decision I made while I was stuck at home to interview as many CEOs as I could. So I've been kind of alternating between CEOs of EMS companies and CEOs of the supply side of the industry. Made In is a show that I co-host with Ron Keith. That's a bi-weekly show, Thursdays, 2 p.m. Pacific every week. You can find all this stuff on my LinkedIn page. That's the easiest way to connect to all those different activities. Made In's been great because we've had Mike McNamara on there. We had Mark Mondello on there, and just recently we had Jim Rowan on there, who was, as I say, just stepped down as CEO of Dyson. So having, and he was also chief operating officer of BlackBerry when they were at their peak. He designed their supply chain and their control tower. So some great guests, some amazing insights. So, and that's just been so much fun to do. I really enjoy doing those, and you know, Thanks to you for inviting me to do this, because I do like a good panel show.
Yeah, I do too. Trevor, you're doing your Tech Talk Thursdays, as we can see on your background. What's that about? Tell people how to find it.
Well, you can find it on our website. It's the easiest place to get to it. But it's been a weekly talk show, basically, on some of the hot topics around the industry and some of the standards. I mean, in fact, we were just talking there just a moment ago about some of the security standards that are going to affect manufacturers in the United States coming out in November, those that are doing military things like that. So there's been some really good debates on there. You can look them up online. They're easy to watch. We're also been doing a weekly series of panel discussions every Tuesday, and they've been very well supported. And we've been doing things like low-temperature sodas. We've been doing things like... yesterday we did X-ray, and that was quite a vigorous debate, shall we say. It was quite entertaining. So they've been very good. We're taking a break now, actually, through August to catch our breath and do some catch up and some other things that we need to do. And we're starting with a new series starting on September 1st, which will roll through the rest of the year on both the panel discussions and the Tech Talk Thursdays. So look out for these.
Excellent. And Mike, you have a trade show coming up. We already talked about it, but remind our audience again when and it is and what it is. And also tell me about your podcast.
Right. So PCB West, we've been producing for 29 years. It's the largest trade show for the industry in the Silicon Valley. It's actually, I mean, I say that Silicon Valley, but the truth is that, you know, year to year we get more than 60 people or people from 60 different countries. So it really is an international show. So that's going to be virtual this year. September 7th through the 10th are the actual dates, although the on-demand program will be available for 30 days following. And the URL is pcbwest.com. And then the podcast, right? So Mike, as you know, because we have been guests of each other, and you actually were the first guest I ever had on mine. So we've been doing it we're coming up on our third year anniversary at pcbchat.com. And it's been interesting, right? That was one of the influences of my wife saying, hey, look, you know, why don't you do a podcast? Like, I listen to these all the time on the way to work, and you really should be doing this. Like, okay. Since that's the first time in 20 years you've mentioned anything about my job, I think I'll actually have to take you up on it.
Better listen, yeah.
So I guess the key to the successful marriage is not talking about work, right?
Right.
Anyway, so yeah, pcbchat.com, and thanks for letting me do the plug.
Of course. Well, I think one of the great takeaways from all of this horrible pandemic stuff is our press and our industry in general has gained opportunity to come up with new platforms to send information out and to communicate and to transfer information, and the information is still going back and forth in a virtual format. I think all of you have done a really impressive job at embracing this technology and making it accessible. So thank you for doing that. I think it keeps it's the glue kind of that keeps our industry together, particularly since we are otherwise very isolated. So thanks for doing what you do. To our audience, information that we talked about today will be in our show notes, as well as links to the upcoming events that our panelists are producing. So check on Spreaker.com, Spreaker.com. Look up Reliability Matters, and all that information will be in the show notes right there. So continue to subscribe. That way you won't miss an episode. You'll get notified when new episodes land. Guests, thank you very much. Phil Stoughton from Scoop TV and many, many other things. Thank you for joining. Mike Bhutto, Circuits Assembly, and Printed Circuit Fabrication? Is that the other magazine, Mike? Or the combined now?
Design and Fab.
Design and Fab, yes, thank you. Thanks for Editor-in-Chief. Thanks for joining me. And of course, Trevor Galbraith, Global SMT and Packaging. Thanks so much for all of you being my guests today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. It was fun.
Really enjoyed it.
All right. Take care, everyone, and stay safe. Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcast. Reliability Matters and other reliability-based podcasts are available at Circuit Assembly's PCB Chat at pcbchat.com and at Ascendo Reliability at reliability.fm. Thanks for your comments. Please keep them coming. Send comments and episode suggestions to Mike at mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.